danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 295 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus, joined by Carlos Welch in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
So you're back from, you were in Reno for Run It Up, right?
Yep, I was there for like 10 days. Basically, I was in Portland and just went down there for 10 days and came right back.
How was that event?
It was great, man. It was amazing. Like, they do a really good job of making, you know, pretty much everybody feel like a VIP player. Like, it's the first time I've played on a RFID table with live stream and everything. And yeah, it was really cool.
Nice. Yeah, it seems like people always have a good time at that.
Yeah, shout out to Kevin Martin and Jamie Kerstetter, who were in the booth when I played on the RFID table, and they both were familiar with me, so that was pretty cool.
Nice. I think you're a bigger celebrity than you realize.
Maybe. yeah. I start to see that sometimes, and like sometimes the people's reactions to me are pretty funny. I'll tell you that I probably mentioned this before, but the funniest one was I was in PCA, and hanging out with Alex, and then Alex introduced me to Jonathan Little. And he told him, at this time I was still streaming on Twitch, and he told him about the van, and Jonathan Little was like, "Oh, you're the guy in the van? I love you." and the time that we went to watch the basketball game in Vegas, and like everybody was just like cool normally, and then when they found out that I was the guy in the van, they all wanted to like meet the van and rushed outside to look for it. Yeah, so I think I'm probably like a mediocre poker celebrity, but that van is kind of like top tier.
I mean, every poker celebrity is mediocre.
True, but the van definitely has more notoriety than I do.
We're going to get a chance to do some A/B testing because, well, actually, I mean, by the time this goes live, this will be available in the Nitcast store at nitcast.com, but you and I have a new set of premium podcasts.
Yeah.
Dealing with single table tournament strategy, although I was saying to Nate the other day, and I still believe this is true, I think even people who have no intention of ever playing a single table tournament satellite, like if they're fans of the podcast and they enjoy listening to you on the show, which I feel like has to be an overlap of one-to-one, like I don't know who likes the podcast, but it's like, but not that Carlos guy, he's not good. Yeah, I mean, I think people are going to enjoy it. Like, I think it's an entertaining enough conversation that, like, even if the actual strategy part isn't of great interest to you, I think there's still a lot there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And a lot of the concepts do somewhat apply to, like, in-game strategy of a multi-table satellite. Mm-hmm. And so there's a little bit of overlap there also.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so we're going to get to find out because Nate and I did one of the, so we did one that was the three of us a couple of years ago, and then Nate and I did one just the two of us a couple of years ago. So now we're going to be able to compare what's the Carlos versus Nate variable, you know, how does the Carlos one sound? How does the Nate one sound?
Yeah. And see the disadvantage that Nate has is that my ego is probably a lot bigger than his. So now that you put that into the universe, I'm definitely going to go overdrive on the marketing.
And see, this is just a long game on my part because I knew all of that. But yeah, I had a good time recording that. Like that, it didn't really even feel like work to me, you know. Like sometimes these, a lot of people, like obviously with you, but even like when we had Stephen von Zettelhoff on the podcast last week, and I'd never spoken to him before, but he's so kind of easy to talk to that it, you know, that was just like an enjoyable conversation. But sometimes this stuff feels like work, which is fine. It is work. But yeah, I mean, I had such a good time recording that. I was like, oh, we're getting paid for this too. Nice.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
So what's your WSOP plan?
So my favorite tournaments during the summer were the 50K guaranteed $400 buy-in tournaments at the Wynn. Those and also the Survivors. Unfortunately, they got rid of both of those. So now there's virtually no Survivors, which sucks. And instead of doing the $400 50Ks, they're doing like 550 100Ks. And for a lot of people, that would be a good thing, like if the guarantee increases. But to me, that's just probate.
Right.
And so I rather like play tournaments that the pros don't want to play, but I'm glad. So that's what I do. Like, this is how I'm different from a lot of people. Like, some pro will like post their package online and they're like selling pieces. I go on there to figure out what they're playing so I know what not to play. And so far, not many of them have been including those win 100Ks. So I'm gonna still play those, but I got a feeling that those fields are going to be tougher than the Wynn fields I've played in the past. But primarily those, and there's a lot of them. I think maybe like 10 to 15 of those throughout the summer. Mm. And also the WSOP online bracelet events up to 1K. And that's pretty much it. I'm not going to play a heavy schedule this year. Like, probably 10 to 15 events max for me.
But you're going to be in Vegas the whole time, or that's the plan?
Yeah.
Not doing this summer school thing this year?
No. That's why I'm not playing the full summer this time, because I don't want to have to do summer school.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. It wasn't the plan to do summer school last year, I think I fired like 25 bullets last year and bricked them all. And so that busted my role, and so I had to go do summer school, which caused me to miss the best year of all time for railing. And so I definitely don't want that to happen again, so I'm going to like slash my playing time in half in order to prevent that.
Yeah, I remember you were getting roughed up in the satellites last year, or the Survivors.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, and now I don't even have a chance to redeem myself. It's like, you know, the long run has been like cut short for me, so now I'm stuck with the bad end of the variant stick.
Oh, because they're not running them again.
Yeah, Wynn is not running them. I think maybe Venetian has one or two, and they're pretty much the only casinos I found in Vegas that do Survivors. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's not a real popular format. Like, it's the opposite of a gambler's format, right? Like, it's for people who don't want to gamble.
Exactly. and that's the other thing that, you know, I'm not even going to talk about. This is this is a public podcast, right? This is not a premium one, so.
Don't give away the good stuff.
Yeah. There's definitely a something that if I am as popular as you say, I don't want to say something that's going to plant a seed in somebody's minds to make something that's bad for me even more popular than I'm afraid that it might end up being. So that's all I can say.
Speaking of popular, I had a nice little, in general, I don't really expect that people are going to recognize me in the poker world. I mean, I would say it happens maybe an average of like half a time a day when I'm in Las Vegas, you know, that someone that I don't already know will be like, hey, aren't you that Thinking Poker guy? So I don't really have an expectation of being recognized in general, but like most people around Maryland Live know who I am because, I mean, A, just because I'm sort of a regular at Live or one of the more prominent players there. And then like between that and the podcast, most people there tend to have like, at least they know like, oh, that's that guy that does that podcast or whatever. You know, like there's sort of that level of recognition. But I was playing a tournament there the other day, and I got to a new table, and one of the dealers asked me where he could find the podcast. So I told him thinkingpoker.net. And the guy next to me, so like his head like, you know, spun around like he was on a swivel. He was like, what'd you say? And I was like, I have a podcast called Thinking Poker. He's like, you're the guy from Thinking Poker? And he like took out his phone, like had it on his on his thing. So that was a nice little experience. Shout out to Stu. That was his name, Stu. Shout out to Stu.
Yeah, and you know, you probably get the same reaction when people first see you versus when they first hear you.
Yes, more people, at least until recently. You know, I've been posting more pictures of myself on Twitter and all, and the beard, as the beard gets crazier, I've become more recognizable. Yeah. But yeah, it used to be that as long as I kept my mouth shut, people would know who I was. And then like once I spoke, you could like see the light bulb go off in their eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've often said between you and Nate, who are the two most frequent people besides myself talking on this show, I have considerable. Just your voices are so rich compared to mine.
Really? I don't even know what that means. I know what it means in terms of Nate for sure.
No, I think you two have a similar like baritone. It's mostly just the deep. Like I feel like my voice is a little more tinny.
Yeah, okay.
So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit of strategy. I have one hand, it's not even so much strategy as it is a combination of like self flagellation and bad beat story, but I don't know. Did you have any hands from Reno that were interesting?
From Reno, let's see.
Or in general, it wouldn't have to be from Reno.
Yeah, I got some hands in my HUD that I can actually pull up now because I have this new computer. Let's talk about this new computer.
Oh, yeah, I meant to ask you about that.
I can actually pull up these hands without crashing the Skype now. That's because fine. I got a computer with an SSD card, which I've never had before. Do you have this?
No. I guess I didn't realize what I was missing until you started raving about it on Twitter, and now I want one.
Yeah, you absolutely have to get it. It completely changes everything. Like no lag, like you can do, like I can play on two different poker sites running two different HUDs while streaming YouTube videos, and like everything just runs super crisp. So basically, it stands for solid state drive, and it's just a faster way for your computer to find the files it needs to run everything. If for any poker player that plays online, or basically anybody that needs to run a lot of different things at once on a computer, it's almost as important as having a mouse. It's super essential.
This is something Nate makes fun of me for a lot because he's a lot more computer knowledgeable or savvy than I, and I think just makes better life decisions in general. But he's like, my computer is fine. It's not like a low end computer per se, but for the amount of time that I spend on my computer and the amount of work that I do with it, like it probably would make sense for me to just have like and I imagine you didn't buy a super expensive machine either, but like it is the kind of thing that like I probably should have a more expensive computer than I do for what I'm doing. And it's just like I know that that's true, but at the moment of purchase, it's still hard for me not to want to save like a couple $100 and be like, oh, this is going to be perfectly fine. But like it probably, even if it's just saving me like 5 minutes a day, you know, and I have the computer for a couple of years, that's going to add up probably to like where it was worth spending an extra $300 on a computer.
Yeah, for sure. And for me, like in the past, I always budgeted somewhere around $300 to $500 whenever I got a new computer, and this one was $350.
Oh, wow.
So it may have been cheaper than some of the more antiquated computers I've bought in the past. And so I'll get you the information on it. Like there's shout out to One Dull Geek, who's a frequent Twitch a member of the Twitch community. He helped me out with purchasing and a few other people online also. But yeah, this thing is great, and they're not as expensive as they used to be. Like, these quote unquote gaming computers used to be, like, you know, out of the reach of the average consumer.
Yeah, they're like $3,500 or something.
Yeah, yeah. And so nowadays you can get a used one for under $500 easily.
Wow. Is that, you got a used one?
Yes.
Nice. Before we get into the strategy, I should let people know that Tournament Poker Edge is our strategy sponsor. And I've got a new series going up on TPE right now, which is a review from a $5 rebuy online tournament. I don't think it was actually part of the W Coop, but I think I played it while I was in Canada for the W Coop. And you know, part of my motivation, I'm not planning on doing W Coop this year. The online stuff has just gotten to be too much of our PokerStars anyway. It's gotten to be too much of a hassle. But part of my motivation for like going to Canada and doing the W Coop stuff is to generate content for making like Tournament Poker Edge videos and that kind of thing. And I know that a lot of the people on Tournament Poker Edge are not playing, you know, $500,000 buy-in tournaments, and like their opponents are different. And I think in some ways it's just a matter of, I mean, if I can be blunt, laziness. Like, I think sometimes people see something in a tournament and, or, you know, they see something in a video and it's easy for them to say like, oh, it makes sense for me not to do that. Like, I don't need to change the way that I play based on what that person just did, because that's not applicable to the people I play against. That's only applicable when you're playing against good players. And so I wanted to give people a chance to see, you know, how am I playing when I'm in a $5 tournament or tournament that, you know, maybe some of the people having that thought aren't thinking, because then that takes away that excuse where they're like, oh, you can't bluff in against, you know, a tournament with $5 players. Like, well, you're going to see the spots where I do bluff or where I think bluffing is profitable, despite the fact that these are $5, or maybe because they're $5 players. Like, I think in some ways, and I know you're on board with us, Carlos, yes. In some ways, these players are more bluffable. And I think people sometimes just use that excuse of like, oh, I just have to play very straightforwardly because my opponents are all bad. And like, I mean, there's actually more room to be exploitive. Probably it's a matter of how you're defining exploitive. Anyway, this is supposed to be an ad. So check out this video on tournamentpokeredge.com.
So the problem with this new computer is that I'm able to use Poker Tracker again. Actually, Poker Tracker is less of a memory RAM hog than Hold'em Manager 2, but that's the one I normally use. So I'm going back to Poker Tracker now, and I don't know how to find things in it. So I've tagged a bunch of hands, but finding them is a different story altogether. But I think I found some. But yeah, so while I'm looking for these, I'll give another life update. Well, a possible life update. I've been talking to Andrew Pieper, who is a poker player that lives in Vegas out of a Prius.
Wow.
And I'm actually considering that. And so, like, he mentioned the idea, like, a year and a half ago, and I'm thinking, like, there's no way my big ass could, like, live in a Prius. But then I started like looking around, and I noticed that like not all Priuses or Prius or however you say plural form of Priuses, not all of them are made the same. So there's some. I actually saw a YouTube video of a guy that was like 6'2", living in a Prius. So I was like, man, I may be able to make this work. So that's something I'm going to be looking into this summer, possibly. Buying a Prius and making that the third version of the Nitmobile.
Wow. What's the motivation for that? The gas mileage?
Yeah, the gas mileage. Yeah, primarily that. Well, actually, you know what? The gas mileage, and also the fact that because it has the battery, or I was going to say electric engine, but I don't know if that's the right thing. But basically, you can let it run all night and basically use that as like your power source. Mm. And so that's pretty cool. Like, I got these little mobile power banks, but if I could like use the Prius to like charge those overnight,
yeah,
that would be a pretty much a game. And then also like for Vegas, if I ever wanted to spend a lot of time there, you could like run the AC all night and it doesn't like, you know, cause your arm and a leg like it would do and a gas with a gas engine.
Yeah.
So the more, like, I didn't even know this was a thing. I knew like people living in a van was a thing, and like there's tons of YouTube videos about that, but I didn't know that was the case with the Prius. So I watched some videos, and there's like a small community of people that do that also. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is, I would not have known that either.
Yeah,
the wonders you bring into my life, Carlos.
Yeah, you know, I'm here for like, I'm like, you know, they got these people that, you know, store like tons of like canned beans in their basement, like these prepper people. Like, I'm like the prepper poker player where, like, you know, if your bankroll goes to shit, you can at least live in a Prius. So this is like a version of like life bankroll management. And it's not like this is like a permanent solution. Like, I'm gonna, like, I've been in this van, and maybe I'll buy a Prius, but, you know, maybe one day I'll bink, you know, $1 million score, and then I'll just upgrade to a bigger vehicle or possibly even a house. So it's like, you got to be able to move up and down in stakes in life in the same way you do in poker. So if you're not willing to play the low stakes in life, then you're going to be forever overplaying your life role.
I like it. And I mean, I do think that's a real, I mean, I know you weren't being entirely facetious anyway, but I mean, I think that is part of the problem for people when they're in life situations that they can, like, that they can't afford or that they can barely afford. They just don't have a lot of flexibility to make any kind of change. You know, if they're at a point where they're unhappy in their job, but they feel like they can't afford to quit their job, or they don't have any kind of runway or can't afford to take any sort of risk to try something different. I mean, the bankroll analogy is, I think it's real and it's apt. Like, it does affect people's, you know, people end up costing themselves in a variety of ways, both money and like just life opportunities as a result of not being bankrolled for the stakes that they're playing.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I have one hand. It's not that exciting, but it is against Leo.
Oh, cool.
So this could be kind of fun. So this is an online tournament that Leo and I played. I don't even know the stakes. It's got to be like a 109 probably. And the blinds are 1530, and there's some sort of ante. I can't even tell how much that is. 40 in the middle. Hell, I guess it's a $5 ante. There's 8 players at the table. So 1530 with a $5 ante, and I have 170 bigs, and Leo has around 70. Action folds around to me in the small blind with ace deuce offsuit. So I raise to 90. Leo calls. And the flop is king 9-6 all diamonds. And I have the ace of diamonds. Ace of diamonds, deuce of clubs. So 220 in the middle. Pretty standard C bet here. I go 90 in the 220. He calls, and the turn is the 7 of diamonds. And I'm not even sure where I'm supposed to pause and like from you. Like, so far everything seems pretty standard, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think technically there are choices on the earlier streets. Like, I'm pretty sure Poker Snowy plays a mix with like, I don't think Poker Snowy has any pure raises from the small blind. Mm-hmm. If it open folds to you, so like in theory, it's probably okay to open limp. I think against a lot of human players, raising is better, you know, against Leo specifically. Maybe there's more of a case for mixing, but like, if you haven't thought about how to, you know, have a small blind limping range, like, I don't know if that's something that you've done much with. And if it's not, it's probably not the thing to try to figure out on the fly against Leo. So, This is Leo Wolpert, by the way, for people who don't know. He's been a frequent guest on the podcast. I'll put some links in the show notes for those of you who are new to the show. It's been a little while since he's been on, but
yeah. Speaking of people who need to be back on soon,
yeah, I've put the invite out there. I think he doesn't play much poker anymore. I mean, it's been a little while since I even invited him. I think he doesn't play a lot of poker anymore, and it didn't seem like he was super interested. But yeah, I mean, I know there's interest on the audience's part.
Yeah, he finds a way to ruin my day online a decent amount for someone who doesn't play much poker anymore. So.
But I was gonna say, so I think flop is, there's a little bit of an option here as well. I'd probably be more inclined to check if my kicker were better, where I wouldn't be as concerned, like a free card would be a little bit less of a concern. Like, I think in theory you do want to have the ace of diamonds. Like, this is one of the spots where mixing is most important, is like when there's a really key card, like, you know, the ace of diamonds on a three diamond board, you probably don't want to be in a situation where like the ace of diamonds is never in your checking range or never in your betting range. You know, in terms of like which combinations are better or worse for checking, like, it probably doesn't matter terribly much, but I would, you know, it probably is a little exploitable if you're just betting here every single time you have the ace of diamonds in your hand. And again, like, Leo is the sort of player, like, the vulnerability really would be in your checking range more so than your betting range. But, you know, Leo probably is the sort of player who might be capable of taking advantage of that.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard to go wrong. I mean, betting is certainly plus EV.
Yes. So now we're on the turn with the nut flush. And there's 400 in the middle, and he has about 1,800 behind. And I, this is a problem. Now, looking at it now, it feels like a mistake. I bet 240. What do you think about this sizing? Or I guess the idea to bet at all.
I think you definitely want to bet. These monotone boards are tricky, because neither player is supposed to put a lot of money in on these boards in general. I mean, blind versus blind may be a little bit different. I don't know that I've looked at them a lot in blind versus blind specifically, like with ranges being so much wider. I mean, if anything, that should push you towards betting larger. But the issue with monotone boards is that there's a couple of cards that are really important. Right, I mean, like the ace of diamonds, the queen of diamonds, the jack of diamonds, whatever. And so, like, if you have one of those cards in your hand, it's hard to go wrong putting money in the pot. But if you don't have one of them in your hand, it's hard to go right putting money in the pot. Like, there's not, I mean, even when there's only three diamonds on the board, there's not a lot of hands with no diamonds in them that, like, you really want to put a lot of money in with, especially since, you know, on an early street, like, there's always the chance that your hand is going to get shipwrecked by a diamond coming later. So the complication is it's hard to bluff on these boards, because when you have one of those big diamonds, you have a pretty good hand. Like I was saying, like when you have ace deuce, I mean, yeah, betting with it is fine and you welcome fold equity, but at the same time, it's not, like, it's a pretty strong hand. I mean, there's a decent chance ace high is good in a blind versus blind spot. Obviously, you have a lot of equity even when you're not good. Like, checking and calling with this hand is perfectly viable on this flop. So, you know, in terms of like a betting range, like if your betting range is just made flushes, sets, two pair, top pair, and really strong flush draws, like that's a very strong betting range. Like, you don't really have bluffs in that range. You know, if the weakest hand you're betting is like the bear queen of diamonds or the bear jack of diamonds, that's a pretty strong betting range. The problem is when you try to bluff without any key cards in your hand, like if you try to bluff without a big diamond, then there's a very real risk that your opponent has a big diamond. So basically, like when you have a big diamond, you don't really need to bluff, or you have a lot of equity and like it's barely a bluff. But when you don't have a diamond, it's hard to bluff because you have to worry about your opponent having one. And it's pretty hard to block it without actually having it in your hand. Like, there's not a lot of ways that you can really block him from having the ace of diamonds unless you yourself have the ace of diamonds. But then it's hard for you to put a lot of money in with the ace of diamonds because you know he doesn't have the ace of diamonds. Like, the chance of him having a hand that can pay you off is pretty slim. But the upshot of all of that is just that neither player is really supposed to put a lot of money in the pot in general on these boards because it's just, it's too hard for either of you to put money in without one of a couple of key cards in your hand. So unless there's just like a big cooler where one of you has the ace of diamonds and one of you has the queen of diamonds, like in general, not a lot of money is going to go in.
Yeah. Okay. So now that I think about it, like you put it in like theoretical language, and with that, it makes more sense for like, this is in my mind, sort of a small bet sizing. And I think you're supposed to have smaller bet sizings when you don't have many bluffs.
Right.
And so for that reason, it makes sense. Problem with that is when he calls and like there's almost like very little opportunity to get all the money in down the river.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably not going to get, like, I think it's too ambitious to try to go for a stack here.
Yeah. Okay, so that's where the mistake was. Okay. So the river was the four diamonds, and now there's about 900 in the middle. He has 16 behind. So now there's like an all diamond board. What do you do here?
Probably just like half pot again. I mean, I don't have a lot of theoretical justification for that besides what I already said, but I mean, I do think that like to overbet jamming, for instance, would probably not be a good idea. I think it's just too hard for you to make that profitable with bluffs. Like I don't really see you taking that line. And again, like this could, like blind versus blind, maybe you do have enough weak hands and it's hard enough for him to have a big diamond that you actually can go for it here. But if you just imagine how many combos of the nuts you have, right? You're probably, I mean, if you're raising ace deuce off, you're probably raising every single ace from the small blind.
Yes.
So you actually have, I mean, even with the blockers on the board, well, that's not blocking any offsuit aces. So even just, you know, times when you have a singleton ace in your hand, that's 39 combos to have just like the ace of diamonds and one other card. Like there's a lot of ways that you can have the nuts here is what I'm saying. And when you don't have the ace of diamonds in your hand, there's a lot of ways he can have the nuts. Like that's, I guess that's the best way of distilling. There's a lot of combos of the nuts here. And you know, sometimes I think people just think in terms of like, oh, if my opponent has the ace of diamonds and I have the king of diamonds or the queen of diamonds, that's just a cooler. Kind of, but it's not like in a spot where, you know, like it's not the same as like a two card straight flush running into a two card straight flush. Like there's a lot of ways your opponent can have the ace of diamonds here. There's a huge step down from the nuts to the second nuts on a board like this one. So you can't really just think in terms of like, oh, I have the second nut, of course I had to put infinite money in. Like that's not really how it works on a four diamond board. And I think you can't really expect that, you know, unless you like massively cooled him where he's got like the queen of jack of diamonds in his hand. I think it's going to be hard for you to get too large of a bet paid off.
So this idea, which I never thought about before, but I like the sound of it, that there's a huge step down from the first to the second nuts when you have these offsuit combos. Does that mean that he's not in great shape here with the second nuts? Like if he has a queen of diamonds, is he not loving life?
Yeah, I think it's like, I mean, it's a profitable call for him, but he's not looking to raise, right? Like, if you bet half pot, I wouldn't expect him to jam with the queen of diamonds.
If I shove, would you expect him to call with that?
Again, he wouldn't be happy about it. I mean, whether or not he would, I'm not entirely sure. Like, I would pretty seriously consider, especially if I didn't know who, like, if it was just a random player, there's a pretty good chance I would fold it. And it doesn't really matter, I guess. Like, so when you're shoving, you either have the ace of diamonds and you're bluffing, right? Yeah. So I mean, for him to have the queen of diamonds is not really I mean, that's, I don't think it's really a meaningful blocker to you. I mean, in some situation, like if you were an under the gun raiser, the queen of diamonds might be a blocker to you having the ace of diamonds. But when you're opening from the small blind and you have like a zillion combinations of ace of diamonds, you know, there's no way to block that. So, yeah, I mean, he just has a bluff catcher when you shove, and it's not necessarily any better than having like the 10 of diamonds when you shove.
Yeah. See, this is a mistake that I've made in my transition from Bovada to ACR. I'm still playing on both sites, but because I've done so well on Bovada recently, my bankroll is such that I can play a higher ABI, and I need to get in more volume at that level, and there's not enough on Bovada, so I've moved to ACR. And I forget that the people on ACR are actually trying to win. And so I think I make some plays on ACR that would be kind of like obvious plays on Bovada, but not against people of Leo's caliber.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking he shouldn't get this far in the hand very often with less than like the Jack of Diamonds. Maybe a King. So, but anything worse than that, I don't think he should be getting too far in the hand. And so if he has, like, I'm thinking like the Queen or the Jack of Diamonds, he's not going to fold. But on Bovada, they're not folding those hands, and they're probably also not folding the King, even to a shove,
right,
which is what I did.
And that's a mentality for like you're saying. I mean, for non-thinking players, or for like level one thinkers who are just thinking about their hand, and they're just going to say like, "Oh, I have the second or third nuts in a blind battle. Of course, I'm going to call a shove." Then that's absolutely the right thing to do. But everything, you know, what you said about it's unlikely he gets this far without the Queen or Jack of Diamonds is exactly why he shouldn't call a shove with them. Right, they're the bottom of his range at this point.
Yeah, like just the idea that idea is just to sum it up for people, like the fact that the second nuts could be the bottom of your range in a spot is something that doesn't come up very often, or maybe it comes up very often. Clearly it comes up a lot, and we just us mediocre players don't think about that. So I'm so glad we had this discussion. The second or third nuts could be the bottom of your range.
Wow. Yeah, and I feel the need to caveat again that this is this may be complicated by the fact that it's a blind battle. Like, this is not a spot I've investigated as closely. If this were like middle position versus hijack or something, I'm a lot more confident in saying that you shouldn't just be jamming here. It might be that ranges are wide enough that like those hands are not actually the bottom of his range for getting this far, and like you can have enough bluffs here to bet. Like, the blind battles are sort of special in this regard, so that's not a spot I've investigated quite as much. But if we set that part aside for a moment, then I think in general, people tend to overplay hands on these boards.
Yeah, I think it will require me to turn some pairs into a bluff on this in this spot.
Oh, of course, and I mean, yeah, you certainly should. Like, they don't have any showdown value,
right? For sure.
Occasionally, they're good for half the pot, but even that's unlikely. And like, if they are good for half the pot, he should often be bluffing. Like, he shouldn't really just be checking back. If he does get to the river with no diamond and you check, he probably should be betting something. So it should be unlikely that you're going to take a hand without a diamond in it to show down and win, or you even win half the pot. Like, his check back should mostly be small diamonds that can win against your non-flush hands.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately for me, Leo's too good, and he did not call my shove. And if I find out he folded the second nuts, I'm gonna be pissed. But I learned from it, and so I gotta. Part of the problem is because this new computer is already costing me money. It's like, because I'm able to play Bovada and ACR at the same time now, I'm not able to compartmentalize those two thought processes in my mind. So I got to start having like ACR on Saturdays and Bovada on Sunday. That's what I got to do, just to like not make mistakes like this. So, all right. So
the other boards that kind of have this character of neither player is really supposed to put a whole lot of money in on them is paired boards. And it's for kind of a similar reason, which is that, you know, it's like if the board is 10-10-5, right, you either have a 10 in your hand or you don't. And when you do have a 10 in your hand, it's unlikely your opponent has one, and therefore, you know, it's hard for him to play a real large pot on that board. And when you don't have a 10 in your hand, you have to worry about the possibility that he does. And again, like when hand ranges are very narrow, like if you're playing against an under the gun opener on a 10-10 X board, you can block 10s pretty well. Like if you have a jack and a 9 that aren't suited to the 10s on the board, then you're making it pretty hard for your opponent to have a 10 in his hand, or an 8. Like basically an under the gun raiser is probably going to have, if he has a 10 at all, it's going to be ace 10, 10 9, jack 9, or pocket 10s. Or, 9-10, jack 10, ace 10, or pocket 10s. You can't really block them from having pocket 10s, but if you can block two of ace 10, 10-9, jack 10, then you're in pretty good shape in terms of blocking his 10s. But like in a blind battle where you can't really block him from having 10s, then it's just, when you have a 10 in your hand, you have a good hand and you don't need to bluff. When you don't have a 10 in your hand, it's hard for you to bluff because the risk of running into a 10 in his hand is too high. And so the upshot of that is just like neither player puts a whole lot of money into the pot or is supposed to.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Makes sense. Okay. So this is actually that same tournament. This might have been the hand right before the last one. So again, we're at the 1530 level, and now there's 9 players at the table. So there's 45 and antes in the middle, and a player opens from UTG1 for a min raise, and we're all like over 150 bigs deep here. Mm-hmm. So UTG1 opens for a min raise. UTG2 3 bets to 270. So that's like 4.5 times the openers. And I am, I don't know what to call this spot. UTG1, UTG2, 3 bets, and I'm 2 seats over. I don't know if that's MP1 or UTG4. I'm 2 seats.
I really don't like that UTG has become, it's so well entrenched now, but we really just ought to be counting off the button. Because the gun, it's confusing. Like, is it 9-handed, 6-handed? Like, off the button is what matters, really. But
yeah, I 100% agree. So I'm going to say an EP open and an EP 3 bet, and I'm in middle position.
Right.
Yeah, with ace queen offsuit.
I just fold.
Yeah, I definitely consider that.
Like, what can your equity against under the gun 2 even be? Never mind that you've still got under the gun 1 raiser who might 4 bet after you call. Or who's going to have equity in the pot, or like someone behind you could wake up with a hand. Like, even against under the gun 2, I kind of doubt you're an equity favorite.
I should say that I think as a default, this should be a full. In this case, I'll say that this isn't this guy's first 3 bet. And the guy's running 33-20 and a 14% 3 bet, which isn't saying a lot. He's only 3 bet once before, but and this was over 20 hands, so it's not a big sample, but I think 33-20 to me that seems pretty active.
It is. Part of it is like, even if he's pretty active, I still don't think you're in that great a shape against his range, and there's still other play. Like, it's not like you're closing the action here. Like, there's still, like, you've still got an under the gun 1 opener who's going to have ace queen beat, I don't know, 20% of the time. Like, there's a fair chance your hand is no good, even if you are ahead of the 3 better. Like, it's not like you're playing heads up against him.
Right, right. Yeah, I agree with that. But in game, I made the mistake of calling here, and so did the opener.
This reminds me of that, I think it was a Jamie Kerstetter tweet. It's like, when you tell someone a hand and their analysis starts with, as played, you fucked it up real good.
Yeah, that was a good one. Mark Alialto used to say, he would ask people about a hand, and whenever they said, well, that's fine, he thought that was like, he hated hearing that. He's like, that means I fucked up. He said, oh, your line was fine. Yeah, that's not what you want to hear. So I call, and now there's 900 in the middle, and we have around 5K behind, and the flop is queen 8-4.
So it was just you two heads up under the gun, one folded?
No, he called.
Okay.
So now we're three-handed with an SPR of about 5, 5.5. And I have top pair, top kicker on queen 8-4. Two diamonds on the board also. Checks around to me. So I think we want to bet here. So I bet 300 into 9.
Yeah, if you're going to bet, you definitely want to bet small. I think against a lot of people, betting probably is correct. I think in theory, like if we were to run this on Poker Snow, well, first off, it would fold preflop, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And I think it would also check the flop, but it's going to be allowing for the possibility that under the gun 2 has checked aces or kings. So I think like your range for cold calling here should be very strong, and people shouldn't really be c-betting into you all that much. But I would expect that like especially an overactive live player, or player in a 109, who I mean, the reason you're calling in the first place is you're assuming this guy is not a not the best player on the site. He probably is just betting, when he can beat ace. He probably doesn't really have the wherewithal to check better hands. So yeah, I think against like subpar human opponents, betting is good. I think against better players, you probably want to check back here. You're not really that worried about free cards. Even without a diamond in your hand, like the flush draw is not that big of a deal in a three bet pot. People aren't going to have a flush that often.
Yeah, and in this case, I actually do have ace of diamonds. So.
Oh, okay. So yeah,
that, yeah. If I was going to check back any, this would be the one to do it. Yeah. But mistake number two, I see bet.
No, I don't think it is a mistake against against who these or who right, three bet likely is, and I don't think under the gun one. I mean, he should never really have aces or kings. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So I bet third pot. And the original opener calls and the three better folds. So now we go to the turn with 15 in the middle and about 45 behind. And the turn is the three of hearts, so just a break. He checks. This time I bet half pot. Do we want to keep betting here?
Yeah, I think we can just assume we have the nuts against this guy.
Yeah. So I bet half pot, he calls again. And then the river is the six of diamonds. So the flush gets there on the river. Mm. There's three in the middle. He has 37 behind. I have him covered slightly, and he checks again.
Interesting. So this is an interesting case. Generally, when we talk about blockers, we're thinking in terms of bluffing or bluff catching, right? We want to block strong hands when we're bluff catching. We want to block strong hands when we're bluffing. Blockers are also nice for thin value betting, which is, it's a lot riskier to bet ace, queen of clubs here. Like when you have the ace of diamonds in your hand, there's not much risk of running into a flush from him. I would expect that he's betting most of his flushes, or even like flush draws, if he's the preflop three better, I would expect that he's going to be betting if he has a flush draw on the flop. So having the ace of diamonds in your hand, I think you definitely want a value bet here. In terms of whether or not you can shove, I mean, I think we do kind of run into the same problem as in the previous hand, where he's just not supposed to put that much money into this board when he doesn't have a diamond in his hand. Do you remember, or I guess you're looking at it, is the queen of diamonds on the board?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, the chances of him having a diamond are not that good. Like, I think it's just kind of hard to see value targets here. I think a decent amount of the time he has a hand like jacks or tens. I mean, I kind of don't see him playing king queen this way for the same reason I don't see him playing aces or kings this way. Like, king queen's a little more plausible, but I kind of think his hand just isn't that good. So I think trying to go for all of it might be a little ambitious. I might just do like 1,000 or 1,500.
Why are you discounting king queen?
I just think he would bet the flop if he had it. Like, I think less good players tend to just c-bet when they like their hand.
Well, I'm the pre-flop aggressive. So
no, you, I thought you cold called the 3-bet.
Oh, yeah, you're right. So I'm not the pre-flop aggressor, but...
I mean, you do have the strongest pre-flop range.
Okay, so the guy... Neither of us is the pre-flop aggressor.
Oh, like you're playing against Under the Gun 1.
Yes.
Oh, yes. He's a good deal more likely to have king-queen. He's also... He might be a little more likely to have flushes. I mean, because the other reason I was discounting flushes is I was thinking the 3-better would bet if he had, like, king-jack of diamonds on the flop. This guy, though, I think at least like king jack and king 10 of diamonds are plausible for him. Jack 10 and 10 9 of diamonds, I would think some people might check raise the flop with a big draw like that, but it's not a guarantee. I mean, I still think you want to bet. I think you want to make the same bet, maybe for different reasons. Just that, like, you don't actually want to put stacks in here. But yeah, I think with the ace of diamonds in your hand, you still get to bet this. I just think you don't want to bet too big.
Gotcha. Makes sense. So he could. So it sounds like you're saying that this guy, he does have a decent number of king queens in his range, but he may not want to call a big bet with that hand.
That's my thinking. And even if he did call a big bet, sometimes with like if he will call a shove with king of diamonds queen, there's enough combinations of flushes in his range that if his calling range is just king of diamonds queen and hands better than yours, that's not really a good proposition for you anyway, in a way that it might be okay against under the gun one, if under the gun or under the gun two, whoever the 3-better was, right?
Yeah,
if we can take flushes out of his range, then it's okay if you rarely get called, as long as you're ahead when you're called. Once flushes are in his range, then we have to worry about we have to make sure that he's getting a good enough price to call with some non-flush hands. Or else, like, I mean, as long as you win more than 50% of the time, it's fine and you want to be betting. But if you make the bet too large, he can just call when he has flushes and fold everything else. Or even if he does call with those other things, it might not be enough to make up for the times that he has flushes.
Gotcha. That makes sense. But I continue the string of errors. And I shoved. There's 3 in the middle. He has like 37 behind. I shove. And he calls with pocket fours for a flop set. So I'm actually pretty that's one of the hands I'm surprised to see. I would expect most people to raise the flop with that hand, especially given that I bet 1/3 pot on a moderately draw heavy board. So this guy, I don't know if fours is the hand he wants to be slow playing with, but most people are vulnerable here because they don't have any strong hands in that check calling range. So I guess, I mean, for me, like, top two is always like the nut, like checking range protector in my mind. But he's not gonna have queen eight here ever, so I guess he maybe like even eights or queens would be better than fours here, because now he's blocking the top of my range. But if he's not going to have those hands, then I think he did a good job of protecting his check calling range by delaying his aggression with the fours and just like kind of letting me barrel off here.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of the, like, it may not be that important whether he's blocking your strong hands, if the hands that are going to pay off a check raise are going to value bet anyway, which is what you did, with ace queen, and this wouldn't even be controversial, right? Had the river not been a diamond, then I would say you certainly want to shove this. So, he doesn't need to check raise to get a stack from ace queen. He doesn't need to check raise to get a stack from aces or kings. On a number of runouts, you should be barreling off with those hands for value anyway. So the main reason that he's checking and calling is that, you know, he's assuming a lot of the value. I mean, this is like, I don't know what he's actually thinking, but like at a theoretical level, and it's like he should be getting a lot of the value he'd be getting from check raising, he should be getting anyway. And then the extra that he's getting from checking and calling is whatever bluffs he's inducing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, this is, like, I almost want to give the guy the benefit of the doubt, even though I don't know the screen name at all. But I can see why there's a chance that these players are just trying too hard. they're trying too hard, and they're not letting me print money like Bovada. Like, again, this is a play that prints on Bovada. So, yeah, that's I gotta actually start thinking more the way I think when I play against Poker Snowy, when I play against some of these guys. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, people are getting better at poker. I mean, there's
something. No, that's the tournaments people. Yes, that's true. The tournaments in Running Up Reno played a lot like Bovada, and pretty much every live tournament I played in the past 12 months have played like Bovada. The people in 109s on ACR are better than I'm used to playing against. Like, these are probably like, these people will probably be competitive in like 1Ks live. So yeah, I gotta start, you know, I gotta take off my mediocre poker hat and put on my good poker hat when I'm playing against these guys.
Do you need a run, or can I share my self-flagellation story?
You can, yes.
So, I mean, it relates to what you're saying about live poker. So this is like, Maryland Live does this thing once a month. They have like a two-day tournament with like multiple day ones, and then the day two is on Sunday. So this is like the very beginning of day two. I think we're maybe like three hands into day two. And I have like an average stack. The guy on my left has me covered. I think I've seen him around before, but he's not a pro. We're a 4,000, 8,000, 8,000. It's a big blind ante structure. And his average stack is like 50 big blinds, I think. So we're 50 big blinds effective. It folds to me in the small blind, and I have ace four offsuit. I raised to 28K, and he says kind of like very genuinely, he's like, well, that's a really big raise. And then like he shows me an ace and folds. And then he said he had ace three, which I believe. So I showed him my ace also, just, you know, to encourage such folds.
Yeah.
And very next hand, it folds around to me on the button, and I have pocket nines. So I open to 20K, which is a size that I like for a button open. And the same player who just folded, who showed me the ace and folded, makes it 50K from the small blind. And it feels so stupid because I'm like, I have nines on the button. And like, but I mean, what is this guy three betting? Like, what, especially to three bet for a small size, you know, like, maybe it feels like a big size to him. But I just like, I feel like when these guys have like ace king or something, they, you know, they make like big raises because they want to protect their hand. So I was just like, oh, how do I, like, how is nines not a huge, like, how am I hating life when I'm opening nines and getting three bet? So I peel the three bet, which is for 50K. So we're like 120 or something in the pot. And the flop is jack five deuce or something, like one of the better flops for pocket nines. And he bets real tiny. He bet like 30K, I think, into, you know, 150. And I was like, okay, I guess that could, like, it feels like a mandatory C bet with ace king or something. So I call with the nines. The turn pairs the board, so it's like jack 5-5-3 or something. He checks, and I decide I'm just going to make like I'm going to bet like 40K just to kind of protect against ace king or ace queen or whatever, and then check back the river. So I bet 40K, and now he throws out three green chips, and it was a little unclear And I'm going to be 100% clear. I do not think this was an angle on his part. Like, I think he was just excited. But he threw out three green chips, and it was a little unclear whether he intended to put out two green chips for a call or whether he thought he was raising to 75K.
Right.
But obviously, he has to make it 80K. So now I'm like, wait, did he just min checker is the turn? Did he mean to, like, I was like, so yeah. I called because I'm getting like 8-1. And then the river's another jack. So the final board is like jack, jack, 5-5-3. Yeah. And he bets 120K into like 330 or something. And I'm like, how can this not be strong? But what strong hand can it be? Like, I feel like, you know, a lot of people, even if he had like aces or kings, I would think he would bet smaller or not at all because he'd be afraid of the jack pairing. Right, like he'd be pretty worried that I had a jack. I don't think he ever has a single jack. Like, I don't think he has ace jack when he makes it 50K after he just like showed me an ace and folded the big blind. So I'm just like, what? I mean, it's just like screaming strength. But honestly, the only thing I think he can have that's strong is pocket jacks. Like, I think he either has exactly jacks or he's bluffing. And I'm getting 4-1. And I was like, am I really saying it's like 80% that he has pocket jacks here? And it probably is, because I called and he had pocket jacks. It just felt like such a stupid spot. I was just like getting insane odds at every point. But I was like, I feel like I should just be able to put him on exactly quads and fold.
What's your logic for him not having aces again?
I don't think he bets 120K on the river with aces.
Oh, once you get to the river. Yeah, I was thinking like kings plus
and up jacks until the river. I mean, I think the min check raise on the turn doesn't feel that much like aces to me, but I wouldn't be shocked. But the river, I was planning on folding to a big river bet.
But then
when the river was a jack, I was like, what is he? It can only be quads. Like, that's the only value hand that makes sense for him. I don't think he plays aces or kings this way. And I'm probably right about that, but it probably is just always quads.
Yeah, that makes sense. I would have been tempted to fold to the turn check raise, even though it was small.
I probably subconsciously glossed over that part because I knew that's where the mistake was. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, that one, like the whole line, just stream strip, but that one is basically like turn his hand over.
Yeah, well, part of the thing was it was not. I wasn't 100% sure he intended to raise. I mean, I think it's more likely that he was excited and threw out a wrong bet size, which again is like consistent with having a very strong hand. Yeah. And like the small flop bet is consistent with top set. Like, I mean, in retrospect, you know, I probably just needed to slow down.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that part. Yeah, the turn.
Until after I was like reviewing the stand, I was like, oh, and he gave me like a 1/5 pop bet on the flop. Like, it was all, you know, like it was like one of those, you know, like the movies where once they reveal the twist ending, then they go back and show you like all the evidence that should have enabled you to come to that conclusion on your own. Like, I just replayed it and I was like, oh, it was all right there.
Yeah. The if he makes like a legit bet on the turns, like on the turn, like even if he, so you made it 40, like if he put in like 80, I think it's a fold. But the fact that there's some doubt whether he meant to raise a call, I can kind of see why you called that. Because if he meant to call, then clearly the river is going to go check, check. And hell, you probably still lose. But at least there's some chance you win. I don't even know if he ever plays eights this way. Like, obviously, that's a hand that he would check call with on a turn, but he probably doesn't three bet that hand. Interesting. Yeah. He probably just has like jacks plus from the pre-flop three bet. like you said, ace king may use a bigger size and he probably doesn't three bet worse pairs than that, so yeah, you probably just screwed throughout his hand.
Yeah, so that was pretty embarrassing, I guess. It was just one of those, like, you know, and I feel like I'm pretty good about not doing this anymore, and I mean, I feel a little justified because it was, I mean, he did have to have quads, but
yeah.
I mean, like, my general philosophy of poker is, like, you need to, like, make them show it to you. Like, don't make it too easy for people to win the pot unless they have very strong hands. And, like, the converse of that is that you pay off when they do actually have strong hands, but we all know it's hard to make strong hands. That's kind of, like, my general philosophy of poker. But then, you know, that conflicts with the they always have it principle.
yeah, though it's so hard to balance those two things. Yeah, that's the central question right there.
Yes, I mean, it's just one of those where, like, I had a terrible feeling about it and paid off the river anyway. and, you know, that's just, that never feels good.
Yeah.
All right, well, have a good day teaching.
I will. I'm right. I can see the school from my parking spot, so I'm going to go ahead and go in here. And
what are you
today's no idea. Well, actually, it's middle school math, sixth grade math.
Oh, that's like your warehouse.
Yeah, but you know, here's the cool thing. This one I don't mind saying online. I don't think any of the school system administrators will be listening to this. Maybe, but hopefully not. There's this cool thing that they have here, cool for me, where if you work, so a work day is like 7.5 hours is a full work day. And you can also work a half day for 3 hours and 45 minutes. And if you work anything above a half day, they pay you for a full day. So this assignment today is for 4 hours, and I get paid a full day rate for that.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm about to go in here at 9, and I think I'm out at 1, and that's a full day. So nice. Pretty cool. But this is a middle school that I haven't been to before, so that 4 hours may feel like 12. But we'll see. But you know what? Those type of experiences, I only have to experience it once. Because if I go to a school and it's like that, I just put them on the never again.
Yeah. Again, it's nice to be bankrolled for that. You know, that you can afford to turn down the worst places.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let me just remind people one more time. The premium podcast with Carlos is available at knitcast.com.
Yes.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.